Hi everyone, Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. On this podcast, we do like to catch up with our industry colleagues to discuss the market and macro environment, along with thinking when it comes to asset allocation. Joining us for the first episode of 2025, glad to welcome back from the UBS Chief Investment Office, Jason Draho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas. We're excited to welcome back to the podcast Rick Reeder, the Chief Investment Officer of Global Fixed Income, Head of the Fundamental Fixed Income Business, and Head of the Global Allocation Investment Team at BlackRock. So with that, Jason, Rick, it's great to be with you both as we embark on a new year. Thank you both for spending some time today with our listeners, our clients. I know we have a lot we want to cover with our audience. So Rick, let's begin with the U.S. economy. Can you provide us with your 1 minute outlook on the U.S. economy for 2025? And more specifically, do you expect growth and inflation to decline, hold steady, or accelerate?
So that's a hard 1 minute question. But I will say our official forecast is we have real GDP of 1.5. We have inflation of 2.5, getting a nominal GDP of about 4. My gut is, though, that number is going to be flatter to the upside. And more so on the growth, but we also have some tilt towards inflation. But I think there's a couple of things at play that are quite significant. One, you have with the new administration, you have a couple of things that are going on, including animal spirits in terms of expenditure that's going to happen alongside of this administration. This inventory build that is happening in an advance of a concern for tariffs. And quite frankly, you still have a consumer where unemployment levels, although ticking up a bit, are still in good shape, and consumers in good shape, and CapEx and R&D from companies, particularly centered around AI, is pretty extraordinary. So my sense is, while officially we are closer to 4 nominal, I could see the data over the next couple of quarters is suggesting closer to something like 5 in the U.S.
Last year was probably kind of coming around 5% when we get the final numbers for nominal GDP. The year before was 6%. So it's reasonable to expect a bit of a moderation. I think that's a fair assessment, but I would put it at, probably end up being closer to 5 than 4 when it's all kind of said and done, with the risk that, the numbers could be skewed to the upside. And that's because of inflation ends up being sticking or accelerating, but more that growth again surprises to the upside the way that has for the past, couple of years. So, that sounds like it's more to the downside, but I'd say almost more kind of flattish, but maybe down, but the risks are skewed more to the upside. And Rick, we kind of set the question, so it's like 1 minute, more of the teaser to, so we can unpack a lot of things going forward. I know it's there's a lot of things to get into. If we think of, you mentioned the animal spirits and sort of the policy, if not the most important question that investors are thinking about right now, but certainly right up there is what to kind of expect from the Trump 2.0 administration. And there's a whole range of economic policies that, from tariffs, taxes, immigration, deregulation, all these kind of things. There's a lot of concern about tariffs, but there's also, the idea of deregulation, unleashing animal spirits. When you think about kind of maybe the overarching view of like how the policy could take shape, do you ultimately think that it will be positive for growth, but also positive for inflation, a different way ultimately kind of net out to be somewhat neutral? Like, how are you thinking, without getting into details of specifics, so we can certainly get into the weeds on that, but just more as a big picture, 12 months from now, how do you think the policy will be shifting the macro environment, good, bad, or otherwise?
So I think there's a timing to it. I think I think you have to assume that, there are certain tenets of this administration that are going to be at the forefront. So immigration, I'm not sure that I don't think there's going to be a significant economic impact on the backside of that. I don't think there'll be headlines. I don't think there's a lot of economic. Tariffs, price adjustment, and a deglobalization, bringing in a sort of this America first set of initiatives, is going to be a really big deal. And so if you take, in the next couple of quarters, my sense is, including inventory build for companies, and you're seeing some of that today, that say, gosh, I can get ahead of this. So my sense is you get a bit higher growth, and like you were saying, a bit more inflation to work its way through. I think there's something that's going to be, two things that are going to be significant over the coming couple of quarters.
one, like you said, deregulation, in particularly in two areas that I think are significant: energy, and by the way, not just deregulation. I think how international negotiation will take place. I think the president will want lower fuel prices, and he's talked about that as a way to get interest rates down, bring inflation down. I think that's going to be a big one. And the second one is deregulation of the financial industry to allow for more lending, to allow for, you know, there's a lot of treasury debt that has to be placed in the system, allow the banking system to own more of it. I think you'll see those two places as a way to get, you know, try and get inflation down, but keep the economy moving along and create some more efficiencies. You know, things like he's talked about, you know, if you put X amount of dollars in, you'll get faster permitting. I think all those things are going to be part and parcel to how, you know, increase productivity of the economy, especially alongside things. You know, you've seen some comments around AI data center, et cetera. And I think those are the things that will work their way through over the coming couple of quarters. But listen, I think when you know, it'll be hard to fight a market perception in the next couple of quarters of growth and stickier inflation, as you would describe it.
So one of the things at a very conceptual level that I'm kind of thinking about, at least what they inherit as an economy this time versus 8 years ago, like it's, you know, inflation is higher, growth is higher, interest rates as a starting point are definitely much higher. So the reflationary set of policies that they, you know, did back in 17, that caused the markets to react in a sort of a reflationary way, that made sense. And in economics 101 terms, I'd say like that was a aggregate demand shift of the curve kind of going out. So you left growth, but you also left inflation. We've come off of years where demand's been strong, growth has been strong, it's also been inflationary. We don't really need a demand positive shock. What we need is positive supply side story. You know, what you described, some of it sounds like, you know, deregulation, you know, whether it's energy, you know, financial services, things of that sort, permitting, you know, speeding up, is all designed towards that. I do, and I think I'm kind of, I lean in that direction that it'll be positive for supply. I do worry, though, that they'll be trying to get a budget deal passed, and they'll ultimately, to get everyone on board, they end up providing maybe more stimulus than is necessary, and so, like, the markets may not like it. What is your, if you kind of think about that frame, like, what is your sense of how it played out? What do you hear things in terms of, like, you know, different policymakers of how they kind of emphasize it? Are they kind of conscious of, like, look, we actually don't want to be too stimulative because that's not good for inflation?
So the one thing that I'm pretty heartened by, there is an increased focus on the debt in the country and about reducing spending. And listen, I think the debt in the country is too big. I think the debt service is too significant. I think the tail risk is in and around the amount of auction debt that we're going to have to place over the next year or so. So I'm pretty heartened that there are, I mean, a number of conversations with policymakers. It has definitely reached a point of concern. And then, listen, I'm a bit skeptical. I've seen some numbers thrown out about how much spending we're going to cut. I actually don't think we're going to get to the numbers that it's hard to debate. It's hard to argue with what Elon Musk can do. But I'm not sure we're going to get those sort of spending cuts. But I will say, you know, one of the things that I think is going to be quite real over the coming, you know, it's hard to see, you know, there's a J-curve effect of this. But boy, I'm pretty blown away by the amount of spend that's going to go into AI and the potential increase in productivity. And, you know, people say, gosh, you know, we'll see that. We'll really see it through the economic data 2 years hence. Boy, I don't know. I see a lot. I mean, every time you meet with a company, we talk about inventory management, we talk about logistics, we talk about, you know, utilizing tools to actually grow demand for their product using, and obviously, whether it's cost of labor or other forms of augmentation of your business that AI is going to contribute to. So point being, I actually think you're going to see some pretty significant productivity gains. And that ultimately will bring inflation down. I think could bring it down quite significantly, but there's a real timing to that. I think it's going to take some time.
So I want to pick up on that point because a kind of a thesis I've, you know, been kind of publishing and writing about for a few years is like a Roaring Twenties scenario, but the analogy is much more like the 1990s. You know, with the internet versus AI. Now we've gone through a hiking cycle, now a cutting cycle. That looks a little bit like 94, 95, 96. So when I think of, like, you know, and I've asked people, like, you know, where do you think we are if you use the 90s as a parallel? Because, you know, people could look at the stock market and think this is 99 and we're at the top. Others would say 96. I've heard people in the technology and the AI productivity, you know, kind of thesis suggests it's more like 92, 93, and it's kind of years away. obviously it matters in terms of like investment implications. I'd rather be 96 than 99 at this point in time. If I were to ask you that question, like how do you, and it's, you know, an imperfect parallel, you can, you know, adjust it as you see fit. Like, how would you think of that as an analogy? Like, where would we be? What are the, you know, the pros and cons in terms of making that kind of comparison? And what are the risks if you either make it right or wrong?
So I think we're seeing something that nobody in our generation has ever seen. So if you take the Mag 7 and how much they've powered the performance of the equity market, and there's something very unique to these big companies in that, and I know you know this way better than I, and the free cash flow they're throwing off, and what separates this so much from the late 90s and the internet is, so years ago, I was looking at the numbers today. So the market cap of this Mag 7 is $18 trillion. They only have $91 billion of net debt. $91 billion net debt, they have $18 trillion market cap. Their EBITDA, those seven companies, is $688 billion. And of that, there's about $400 billion that is free cash flow. $400 billion of free cash flow. So just put it in perspective, you go back 20 years ago, the free cash flow of the entire S&P 500 was $322 billion. This group throws off $400 billion, seven companies, and then their ROE, so I was looking at it, so if you throw out like NVIDIA's, I mean, the number's scary high, but then you look at these other companies, and you say, gosh, you're throwing off 30, and read the Meta 36, ROE, Google 32. Boy, oh boy. I mean, you know, your ability, to, even if your multiple, even if you're trading at multiples, like some, you know, they're trading at 25, 30 multiples, you know, than who it is. Tesla's different. But gosh, if you're trading at 25, 30 multiple, but you're 30 ROE, you have no debt, your free cash flow generation is, by the way, your free cash flow generation is so big that somebody, many of these companies, Meta, Apple, they're buying back more stock than their free cash flow generation, and you can still spend on CapEx and R&D. I mean, and if you go back, like you said, you know, if you go back, we had big companies before, the GEs, the Exxons, the Mobil, the Ford. You know, these companies used to borrow. They had a big, you know, big labor infrastructure, and they didn't throw off, I mean, you know, the free cash flow generation wasn't that. I mean, these numbers, and by the way, they in terms of their scale in their markets, you think about what Amazon is or what Meta is, they do, you're oligopoly bordering on monopoly, but in industries where, you know, monopoly is usually like, gosh, that's a bad thing. But actually, people love the companies because it's bringing their costs down. Think about what Amazon's doing, what Meta's doing, what Google Search does. Nobody's ever seen this, and it's staggering. $400 billion of free cash flow from seven companies. That is remarkable. And so anyway, I get excited about it, but I think it's. I don't think it. I mean, it's just hard to compare it to anything else because you've never witnessed this. And by the way, with AI, with the spend on AI over the coming number of quarters and data center and energy, you know, it's hard to see like 30 ROEs are going down a lot.
If we go back to 2020, like 2 years ago this time, the consensus view was the U.S. economy would go into recession. And of course, it did not go into recession. If anything, you know, growth was far, far higher than what people anticipated in 23. And even last year, I think the consensus at the start of the year was something like 1.1%. We'll probably end up around 2.6, 2.7 for GDP growth. So there's a lot of people kind of scratching their heads of like, you know, what's going on in the economy? They could, you know, point to say it's all debt finance, whatever it might be. But I've also had a view, this is pre-pandemic, that the U.S. economy is very different than it was 50 years ago, like in the 1970s. And just the nature of the economic activity, and, you know, these tech companies are kind of part of the story, is it just less prone to kind of the cycles. It is, like we're basically an information-based knowledge economy or services-based knowledge economy. Therefore, unless there's some real adverse shock, by and large, we should not have recessions, you know, that this cycle can go on for a long period of time. A year ago, I remember earlier last year, I think I heard you on, might have been on TV, talking about, you know, the economy, like, you know, we really don't need to have experience of recessions anymore. And that may be taking you out of context, but like, I think it's relevant in terms of like the question, like, where are we in a cycle? As people think about the playbook across, you know, early, mid, late cycle. So what, I guess my question is sort of two parts is like, how much do you agree with sort of the idea that, you know, the U.S. economy by and large is much less cyclical, and therefore how to think about the cycle is different, and therefore maybe we'd be thinking about slight cycle, mid cycle, that's probably the wrong way to think about investing at this point in time.
Yeah, I think, you know, whenever I hear this, you know, this is the classic X pattern. I don't think there's anything classic about this. I think there is a, I think 70% of the economy's service, or certainly serve the consumption, is 70% of services and what people spend. There's a demographic to it in healthcare and education. And, you know, that is just sticky. What people pay for their, whether their internet service or cable service, there is just a stickiness to it that is core, that is quite real. And I don't think goes away, and it goes away anytime soon. And so, you know, plus, and by the way, it's hard to argue with it. You know, there's some, when people say, you know, this is all debt financed or debt stimulated, I think there's truth to that. And I think if you said that's what it is as the answer, I think it's incredibly cynical, because there is, you know, you have what is a mature economy that operates. It's not hard assets, not commodity. It's not export driven a la China. China exhibits real cyclicality to it. But I just don't think this economy will do that anymore. Save, you know, I know I've used this quote before, in 75 years, there's only been two recessions in services, pandemic and financial crisis. And unless you tangibly shock the system, people are going to spend the same amount of money on, you know, on their cable bill as they have in the pie in, you know, a quarter ago, 2 quarters ago. Listen, there, and I, by the way, I don't mean to be naive to the fact that, you know, can hiring slow? It obviously can. And, but, you know, you're starting from a pretty good place today. And, you know, I think we're hiring, you know, there'll be something over the next couple of years around AI and, you know, and massive amount of potential augmentation and job replacement. You know, that's going to be an interesting period of time and how that plays out. But, you know, I really, otherwise, I don't believe. I think the U.S. economy, by the way, is U.S. economy imports and exports a fair amount. By and large, it's a closed economy that operates domestically from, you know, the sheer aggregate size of it. So I'm much more relaxed about, I'm not relaxed about the debt in the country. I think that's a problem. But I'm, you know, if you said to me, in the, you know, my book of constants and variables, I feel good about the economy is doing its thing.
So given that, given, you know, the view of, on the overall state of the economy, fiscal policy possibilities, thoughts on the Fed of like what they'll do, how much they'll cut this year. Our official view is 225 basis point cuts in June and September. You know, so the Fed needs some time to see more data to get comfortable. You know, the timing obviously could, you know, be very subjective, but the direction of travel is still for the Fed to cut rates this year. And the risk of any hikes is, in my mind, it, you know, is single digit probability probably. Where do you kind of stand in terms of what the Fed is likely to do?
Completely agree. I think a March rate cut would be, you know, given what we described about the data in the first quarter and you know, potentially the unknown around what inflation could be. So I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I will say today, you know, maybe because I'm enthusiastic about these growth numbers. And by the way, there are some places like you're seeing in the hiring, you know, the actual number of hires is coming down, the fixed rate's coming down. I mean, there's no doubt there's some softening at play in some parts of the economy and hiring. But the, I think I wouldn't argue with that as the two cuts, but if I had to bet on more cuts or fewer cuts than that, I would bet on fewer. Unless financial conditions change significantly, you know, unless you had some tangible weakness in employment, you know, like you say, the Fed's going to wait, let's see the data. But, you know, I would say today, coming into the beginning of this year, it's sort of hard to see them cutting anytime soon.
Kind of follow up, so that's the Fed. You know, I would agree that it's probably more likely that the economy holds up enough, they just don't need to cut, you know, even twice. But it's, you know, it's definitely filling questions about like the back of the curve, like the 10-year, which is up about 100 basis points since they first cut back in September, which is a highly unusual development. I think most of you look at like real rates, what the market's pricing, where the growth is, it's sort of justifiable that, you know, rates were too low back then. They've kind of gone higher, but adding the concerns about larger deficits, term premium have gone up, you know, there's certainly anxiety when you look at what's happening right now in the UK with the gilt, the 30-year gilt, that the highest has been since 2008. Definitely concerns about the risk of rates going higher. As someone, like, you know, and we are right now, just for clarity, sort of recommending like a 5-year duration, 5 to 7 years kind of the target, you know, not wanting to extend duration. And this is from last fall, just from the fear that rates would go higher. These levels, I've seen some people say, now it's kind of getting interesting to want to step back in. How do you think about kind of the curve overall, you know, where rates could go at the back end, you know, and maybe where you see opportunities, the best way to position on for duration right now.
You know, I'm pretty biased in my portfolios towards, I don't really, you know, I'm not, you know, if I were a life insurance company or pension fund, I'd have a, maybe a different disposition in wanting long bonds. I just don't know until you build in enough term premium, you know, why, you know, I look at my portfolio and say I can own equities, which is a long duration asset whose company's throwing off 30% ROE, or I can own long bonds and pray that maybe, you know, when the Fed starts cutting, rates come down, but I know when the rates come down, the curve's going to steepen. Like, I don't, you know, unless there's some geopolitical shock or some exogenous shock to the system, I just don't know. It's I don't need the to be one of those thrill seekers trying to figure pick the bottom on the long bond. I think we're going to auction off an awful lot of debt, and that's when I think Secretary of the Treasury will thoughtfully extend the term, extend the WAM of the weighted average maturity of the debt in the country. And so I'd much rather, you know, there'll be a point in time if, you know, if the Fed is cutting aggressively and we can't get yield in the front end, but we're building portfolios where you get 6.5% yield, low single A rated, using mostly the front or the belly of the yield curve, and not having a stretch in the aggressive parts of the EM or, you know, down to triple C high yield. It feels okay to me. Even if inflation is 2.5 to 3, like, you know, we could run a relatively low risk yielding portfolio sitting on the front of the belly and not have to care what the long bond does.
So then in terms of spread product, sounds like kind of shorter duration, like not taking a lot of duration risk. Where maybe within kind of the spread product space, you know, would you like? Is it corporates? Is it structured, something else?
So it's a bit, you know, we've evolved it a bit over the last couple of months. Like, I think the investment grade credit market at these spreads is not terribly interesting. In Europe, we still, you know, there's still some opportunity in Europe because of the dollar investor, because of swap back the dollars. But I still like high yield, and I, you know, not down the triple C's. I don't think we need to do it. Like, you know, single B, double B high yield in US and Europe. I like, and then securitized products. Across the board. I mean, there's parts of like office and commercial CMBS we're not a big buyers of at all. But generally securitized in resi, in general asset back, we think makes a bunch of sense today. CLO, AAA CLOs, even buying some mortgage floaters. Generally we're higher quality in aggregate than we've been, and we've reduced some of the spread beta by taking out some of the IG that's gotten pretty tight. Those have been the big ones. You know, still conservative in EM, you know, some hard currency EM we bought in Mexico, but still pretty conservative in EM for now. You know, like I say, you know, these yields, real rates are really attractive in the front of the belly and being in decent quality.
I think our general view has been sort of up in quality for fixed income because you can get, you know, pretty attractive yields without taking a lot of credit risk. And if you want to take more of that risk, then in simple terms, the way I think of it is like I'd rather own the equity tranche of corporate America than the credit tranche, given, you know, where the spreads are and given the upside. The question we often get, you know, say from our advisors, is you have a forward multiple for the S&P that's 22 or even above, depending on, like, you know, where the market's exactly at that point in time. People point to the market concentration. You know, the counterpoint of all the numbers you gave in terms of the cash flow, the generation, kind of these oligopolistic businesses that, you know, have a pretty good motor on it. So it's, you know, still very attractive. It's something that, you know, we see upside in equities. We like the tech sector as our most attractive sector. But, you know, given how it's performed, you know, it can't continue indefinitely. So the question is, like, you know, is this another year or not? We basically think so. Where within the equity space, are you, or would you kind of play like those areas that worked more working, or do you think scope for broadening out this year, parts of international markets like Europe, you know, is underpriced, or at least cheap on a relative basis? You know, some positive surprises on tariffs might be like at least a bit of a rally there. So how are you thinking about, you know, to the extent you're kind of playing in equities, or just your general views on equities?
Yeah, no, I mean, you run big equity proposals. So I don't find Europe intriguing. I don't, other than valuation, and I've often found that valuation is not a determinant of future return. unless there's some growth catalyst. And I think it seems to me, I just travel all over Europe, and it seems like there's more motivation for austerity to bring down the debt and regulation of tech than promotion of tech. So I don't find that interesting. I don't find small cap really interesting either. I think the companies in and around data are just unbelievably exciting. And, I talked about the mega cap. I really, we've evolved some of that positioning in which parts of mega cap that, where we have some of our bigger exposures. But I like tech. We've moved around our exposure in financials. I'm starting to get intrigued by financials again. I think the DREG is real, and I think it'll free up a fair amount of capital. So I think the financials are interesting. I think there are, parts of healthcare, particularly in and around robotics, automation, equipment that are that we think are attractive. And I always feel like, we got to be careful we're not hanging at the bar too long. But I still think the consumer is going to hold up pretty darn well. So the big cap consumer-oriented companies, and by the way, airlines, I think trade at a very cheap multiple. And I think there's a cultural movement towards leisure and hospitality. So some of the travel areas, I think the individual names, but some of the hotel management companies and airlines, I still think the consumers, and particularly the high-end consumer, is in the mid to high-end consumers in good shape. So that's where we're going. I'd like to reiterate one point you said. I don't really understand. I think small cap, I think, is hard because I think the data is such a big advantage today. I think there's an incredible dichotomy between fixed income and equities now. And like consumer staples or, some of the traditional autos, some of the traditional telephone companies, et cetera. Like in the debt markets, we do a ton of financing and they're great to lend to. I just don't find, and again, it's not universal, there are a couple of idiosyncratic situations within it. But on equity, I'd much rather be like, I don't know why I need to own consumer staples. If I need yield, I just get a fixed income. In equities, I like the bottom of the cap stack to take on growth, and then the fixed income to lend to more of the traditional businesses that don't have a lot of growth stimulus.
So one kind of final question to kind of wrap up. It's maybe kind of like in simple terms, kind of what would you think it would be your out of consensus view, or where do you think maybe consensus is wrong? Because it feels to me like the consensus is most people felt pretty good about the U.S. economy, believe in the U.S. exceptionalism story that will continue to outperform the rest of the world for some of the reasons you alluded to with Europe. Comfortable with tech, it's not uniformly consensus, but it feels like there's a pretty common that view that people have. There's a few, those who might worry about inflation going lower. There's an odd person who's calling for significant slowdown, but it feels like it's pretty consensus. The one area that I feel like I would maybe disagree with some of the consensus, it does feel within some parts of the investor community that the policies from the Trump administration would be very reflationary. I've kind of thought they actually might be not disinflationary, but less reflationary than people are assuming. It won't be Trump 2.0, will not be Trump 1.0. Where is there part of the consensus view, however you want to define it, that you say, I think that's not right, and I have a different take on things?
I'm much more enthusiastic on growth than others. I think I'll get right to the point you made. I actually think that the way we're going to get inflation down, I'm actually surprised that oil prices have been rising, because I actually think that's going to be the place that there's going to be pressure to move price down. And, while the market seems to be buying upside, I'm buying the other way in oil. Now, there are some dynamics in that gas and nuclear, et cetera, that are going to be stimulated by AI. But I actually think you could see more pressure on energy. And then the other one that I have a more, I think, aggressive view than most is, I just got back from the Consumer Electronics Show. I think AI is a thing. I believe in it. I think it's going to be powerful. And, but the other one that I'm more aggressive on, I think this debt thing I hear people quite a bit talk about, we've always had significant amounts of debt. I think people underestimate how we're going to have to be auctioning as much debt as we're going to have through auction, unless there's significant policy to address it. I think that's going to be one of the one of the parts of the risk factors you got to be really, really careful about. And I hear people, I think people are very sanguine about it, I think, as well.
Well, your comment about you don't want to stay at the bar too long, I think that might apply to, like, the U.S. government staying at the borrowing bar a little too long. I think the chance of any bigger crisis here is still quite low, but it wouldn't surprise me to see a bit of a mini tantrum where rates kind of go higher that spooks people, and it might also spook the administration and you know, Congress to be tamped down a little bit what they want to do on the fiscal front. I feel like that almost has to happen before they get a little bit of kind of religion to, you know, maybe it actually would be beneficial to the economy if we be a little more deficit hawks, bring down inflation, bring down rates. That actually would be the best thing for the economy, but we might have to have a little more pain on the rates front to get there first.
I hope not, but I fear, you know, I've found, you know, I've said this before, I think policymakers tend to react when the shark is right next to the boat. And I know, I, as opposed to being proactive, but I hope I'm wrong.
I hope so too. But we're prepared for the worst.
30 minutes goes quick as always. So with that, Rick, Jason, thank you both for spending some time today with our listeners here on How Should I Be Positioned? And thank you very much for covering all of the ground with us that you did. I do look forward to continuing with the conversation at some point, though. Rick, Jason, thank you again for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you for joining us, and good luck in 2025. It'll certainly be interesting.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, guys.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights, at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliate, UBS. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient and is published for informational purposes only. As a firm providing wealth management services to clients globally, UBS AG and its subsidiaries offer both investment advisory services and brokerage services. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. In the USA, UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS AG and a member of FINRA SIPC. For information, please visit our website at ubs.com/workingwithus. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investor investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.